Poet Runner is a podcast where we talk about poetry and writing. First off, we have Yago Kura. After Yago, we'll have George Southgate, a 75-year-old marathon runner who's actually run 500 marathons. But first, we have Yago. How you doing?
I'm good, Rafa. Thanks again for having me on, and thank you for doing this kind of this show where you're kind of bringing two disparate elements that don't seem like they have anything in common, but kind of do.
It's kind of me being selfish because I love both things and I'm actually involved in both things, so I get to learn about both things. So,
for
what
sure.
Projects have you been up to? What projects have you been up to lately? I know you got Hinchy Press, and I know you published a couple things.
Yeah, man. Yeah. You know, most recently, what we did was we published an anthology called Tlaquilix. And it's based off the work of painter Sandy Rodriguez and kind of, you know, talks about the, you know, decimation of Tenochtitlan, which happened in 1521. And so, you know, the book was published in 2021. So it's kind of like 500 years into the future. What's changed? What issues do the people that live, you know, in California along the border and in other places, do they find, you know, important? So it's a great work. Right now, this very moment, I'm actually waiting for the galley for another book we're doing called Renault 30. And this is a poet from Miami, Abel Folgar. And we got Pilar Marrero to write an intro for us. She's a Venezuelan journalist. So the book is a book of English, like American poetry, but it's mm-hmm. about growing up in Venezuela in the 70s. And, you know, talks about, you know, a lot of things that are happening in Venezuela right now. So, you know, we're really looking forward to that and, you know, hoping to make a splash with that. And then also working on Librarians with Spines, Volume 3, which is another series that Inchas Press does. Thank you for asking that question, though, Rafa.
So the Librarian one, how many have you done of that one?
The Librarians with Spines, this is our third volume.
And,
oh, I'm sorry.
Actually, tell us what's in the volume. What do you publish inside that in the volume? Poets,
okay, awesome. Thank you.
Inside?
Well, the Librarians with Spines is like it is an anthology of essays about librarians practicing best strategies and how to reach their clients, their community. And so the reason we are doing this is because, you know, I work as a public librarian for the city of LA. Mm-hmm. And, you know, this work is like very dear to my heart. It's also for me a venue to ensure that librarians of color are publishing chapters. A lot of the times the publishing world is so white that a lot of the times they just want to publish the stories that they think like white audiences want to hear. And I have a very different view about what Latino audiences want to hear. So Librarians of Spines is just a vehicle for, you know, publishing those essays, you know, chapters and, you know, giving some kind of notoriety to some librarians of color who are out there doing the difficult work in communities that we need to get done.
Sounds cool. Actually, it sounds really – actually, it sounds like it's something worthwhile that should be done. It's kind of you – know, I like it. I just like that it's being brought out because, I mean, a lot of things are catered to a white audience, unfortunately, even freaking – people don't realize, but it's like, ah, oh, man, I am so sick of the white savior, you know, and anything.
Yeah, man. Yeah, you know, it's almost, it's like with running, too. It's kind of like, oh, you you're brown. Why do you jog? Like, brown people don't jog. That's like a white thing. And there's all these expectations and behaviors that we sometimes people of color label as white, which I think is very limiting. You know what I mean? It's like, yo, if I'm a person of color and I want to, you know, run marathons, there should be no problem with that. I shouldn't have my friends or family be like, why are you acting so white? You know, because that's a weird thing to say, you know? I appreciate that, Rafa. I know that you understand, you know, as a person of color too, you know, it's always like, you know, they want to tell our stories, but they don't want to give us the credit and they don't want to give us the money that you know, those stories make, right? So,
want to take the stories, the stories and exploit them and make them their big movies, but it's kind of wild.
Right.
I mean, I think about, I don't know, about for 4 years, I actually worked with a white guy at the dishwasher, and I used to give him a bunch of shit. I used to call him privileged white boy because I go, dude, what are you doing here? You're supposed to be a cook. You're not supposed to be a dishwasher. What the hell? You know, I mean, Jesus Christ, did you listen to Trump a little bit too hard trying to take back the jobs?
Right. Right.
But yeah, but it was weird. A white guy washing dishes. When, you know, the funny thing about, and I agree with you about Latinos, is that I have met doctors and lawyers from other countries washing dishes only because they can't get a license in America because they're not given a fair shake, or they had to get here illegally just to survive. You know?
Yeah, that's very, very prevalent, man. In fact, you know, it's not just Latinos. You know, when I lived in New York, I used to play soccer with a lot of cab drivers who had master's degrees in economics from, you know, universities in West Africa.
Yep.
So, I mean, you know, we're not, Latinos are not the only, definitely not the only ethnicity, you know what I mean, that is not given their fair share or has to kind of, you know, go, you know, how can I say this, cower into another kind of role when they immigrate to this country in which they're paid crap and treated like shit. So, you know, it's very interesting. You know, my parents are immigrants to this country, so it's something for me that's very, like, always on my mind, you know, and I feel very fortunate that my parents were immigrants to this country. Like, I feel like I'd be completely different if, you know, I was a second generation American. And, you know, I think part of the thing is to, like, not lose sight of what my parents, you know, had to sacrifice to get us here. It's very, very, like, on my mind all the time, you know?
I mean, I grew up very white, and I didn't like it. I didn't like it years later when I realized my name got changed the first day I went to first grade in a Catholic school. They said, well, Raphael's a little hard for the students, so we're going to call you Ralph.
Right. And it's like, man, you know, I don't see Latino people going up to a dude and being like, I cannot pronounce your name Connor, so we're going to call you Condor. You know what I'm saying?
Oh, yeah.
Like, there's no Latino people are not going up to people and saying, you know, your name is too hard for me to pronounce, so I'm going to call you something else. But it's completely fashionable and you know, likely to happen to you in this country, you know, which is, I think, very telling of our society, not so much of other people, you know?
Well, yeah, I mean, I kind of wish there would be more stories and more poetry about instances like that where, you know, our culture is being, you know, it's taken away from us, because when you go to school, you're basically taught to assimilate. You're taught to, like, you know, this is it. This is what you have to learn. You're not taught your own culture. They don't
for sure
give
that's,
you any books about where you come
totally
from.
Right. That's totally right,
yeah.
Man. And in fact, most people, including myself, we have to wait till college to even get an inkling about our history. And I'm not even talking about, you know, Latin-centric histories. I'm just talking about Howard Zinn. It's like, you know, I had to wait to get to college to have a professor turn me on to a historian that was looking at it from an angle that, you know, is better suited for my ethnicity and my history, you know. So I'm not even talking about Latino historians. I'm talking about, you know, whitest, you know, Howard Zinn. But even Zinn is kind of like kept from people until they get to college, and it really shows. It really shows in our society and how ignorant we are about certain things, especially our history, you know.
Well, no, I agree, and I agree. Right, the bottom line to me is, I feel really bad for my kid right now because I don't know how bad his history lessons are going to be in school because they don't teach you the Harlem Renaissance. They don't teach you anything about, you know, anything about culture or Hispanic mm-hmm. culture. And if they do, they have – the heroes are George Custer, who was a nut. You know, because I remember
right.
growing up, George Custer was a hero when he was being taught. I don't know if he still is now. But
for sure.
Back when I grew up, they treated him like a hero. You know, it's just,
yeah. I mean, because, you know, he gave his life, right? And like, that's the highest honor, you know. So it's so interesting to me that, you know, it's like the heroes give their lives, and it's really easy for us to see them in American history. But the minute you start talking about Denmark Vesey, the minute you start talking about other people who gave their lives, you know, for a cause, you know what I mean, John Brown and stuff like that, then it's like, oh, no, we don't really want to talk about that. But, you know, people have given their lives for causes and rightly so. And that history is a lot of the times it's just kind of suppressed, you know. But also, Rafa, you know, I think, like, the fact that your kid and my kids can, you know, count on us understanding our history and not wanting to leave it out is good for them because it means we're going to educate them about what their history is, and like, man, that's really, I think, a place of privilege, right? Because like, you and I both, we're not just readers, we're also writers, and we're students of history. So, you know what I mean? I think it's kind of, you know, they're kind of lucky in that instance, right? I think.
Oh, I want my son to know who Ruben Dario is, who Miguel Hernandez is. I want him to know who his granduncle is, who he's named after, because his middle name is Cardoza after his granduncle. I want him to know he has poetry
right.
in his blood. You know, I want him to know
That's
where he
right.
comes from. I don't care if he becomes a poet, but I want him to know the family history. And I know a lot of people
For
in
sure.
this culture don't know their family history. They don't, you know, and even poets that are writing right now don't know poets as far back as Paul or somebody. They just know the poets around them sometimes. And that kind of, you know, when you mention,
yeah.
I mean, there's a lot of great new poets, but a lot of these great new poets don't know a lot of history.
Yeah. You know, that's the thing too. It's, you know, people are coming at it from a different angle. I mean, Rafa, you and I have known each other for what, more than almost 10 years. And like, you know, I don't really
yep.
mess around with the poetry scene in LA because there's too many poets trying to make a living off of poetry. And like,
yep.
I think that's one of the biggest mistakes you can make. Like, I don't, like if I'm in LA and you introduce yourself and you're like, I'm a poet, and you know, I'm going to be like, oh, what, you know, what do you do for a living? And you're like, nothing. I don't want to know you. I don't want to know you
yep.
because every poet I know has a day job. Every single one.
Well,
there's
yeah.
not a poet that I know that doesn't have a day job. The poets that don't have day jobs, they have to start GoFundMes so that people like
yep,
me
yep.
and you can pay their rent. And I'm just not doing
well,
that shit. That's not
Robert.
That's
Robert
not me.
Pinsky was a professor. Robert Pinsky was a teacher. Most of
right.
most of the academic poets
right.
had day jobs. They didn't make all their money, you know, going around doing readings. They had day jobs. They were professors.
Even,
they were teachers.
Even now, F. Douglas Brown teaches at Loyola High School. This person teaches here. This person teaches there. Douglas Kearney teaches at like at Otis or one of these schools, right? So it's like
yep.
it's like all the writers that I know have day jobs as teachers. The only place where I've been to where people introduce themselves as poets and then give their occupation as poets is Los Angeles. And the reason that is because they live off of other people. And I just
yep.
I don't think that's the way to do it. I think, yo, you pay your own way, you pay your own bills. There's no reason why you need to do a GoFundMe so I can pay your rent, right? Like, there's no reason.
Oh,
like,
yep.
you go out and get a job, and then you do the poetry when you have time, right? Because the real work is justifying your existence on this planet, right? The poetry comes after, I feel, you know?
Right now there's two poets I've actually had on the show, Iris De Anda, who I respect because she actually, you know, put stuff out there that, you know, relates to things that are going on, and Gina Durin, who actually is all about healing, and they don't talk about money or wanting money, which impresses me, you know? They don't talk about getting paid for gigs. I mean, we'd love to get paid for gigs, but getting paid is like, that's secondary to writing poetry, you know?
Yeah, I mean, right. No, I mean, and they're very strong in the community. I've known Edith as long as I've probably known you, and, you know, she's been at it for that long, and so, like, kudos to her, you know, and what she's doing, and for sure a lot of respect, you know. They're healers and writers.
Yep.
And, you know, I feel like...
I appreciate that.
You know, a lot... Yeah, there's, you know... There's a lot of good writers in LA, and I guess my only point is that for me, the good writers are the ones that aren't trying to make a living off of the poetry. They're not like anyone who's like, I got into poetry because of the money is laughable.
They're nuts.
It's not even
what not, money.
It's not even a joke. It's kind of like it's like almost like offensive. You know what I mean? To say something so dumb. You know what I mean? But, you know, that doesn't mean that you can't sell 3,000 books and, like, you know, make some money with poetry, right? Well, it just means that, like, you know, I don't know what it means.
Well, I
don't know. I'm
look
still
at Michelle
Steros.
Michelle Steros didn't stick with sticks poetry. She ended up writing a young adult novel, you know. She was the first kind of to write one of the first Latina young adult novels. And then she went on to the George Lopez show. But she didn't depend on poetry, you know.
Right.
She didn't, like, sit around saying, you know.
That's my point.
But she was also a good hustler. Yeah. She was good at hustling her books at the shows, you know. She didn't sit around just like, well, here's my book. She was out there, you know. And she was more
for
like
sure.
She was a good show person. She was good at, you know, getting people excited about the work. And that, you know, if you really want to sell your poetry, you got to go out there, do readings, and promote yourself. But getting paid for it, tailoring yourself for paying gigs, I'm afraid of the same thing that it's going to happen to you as you're suddenly writing to fit the audience, you know?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, there's also the thing, like, after a certain amount, for example, there's a great local writer, Kamwa Daoud, right? And I was working for the library, I called him up and I was like, hey, man, would you like to come and do a program here? And he was like, okay, well, how much are you paying me? And so, you know, at first it was, you know, kind of took me back, but you know what? I think Kamwa has a very good point. It's like, look, you're calling me to come and do a program. I'm the person with the expertise. I'm the person with this history of literature. What are you going to pay me? And, you know, I'm not saying that, you know, I didn't have any money to pay him. So, you know, a lot of the times we're doing programs for free. But my point is, you know, who knows what his rate is. My point is that kudos for him for being like, look, man, this is work for me. I have to prepare. I have to get my notes. I have to edit some poems. That takes time. And are you going to pay me for my time? And, you know, I think there's a difference between what, you know, that and him being like, I only make money selling my poems, which I find you know, ridiculous, and some of the poets out here in LA try to do, right? Because their parents are paying their rent, and that's why, you know, they try to make money on poetry, right? Because they don't have to worry about that stuff. But, you know, we're not all that fortunate to have our parents pay our rent, right? So we got to go out and hustle and kind of figure it out, right? So that's what I'm saying, you know what I mean? And you're totally right about Michelle Steros. What a great model to have, you know? What a great person to try to emulate.
She had a wicked sense of humor, too. She was always, you know.
Hell yeah.
She called up one time when I first started doing the podcast. She called up pretending to be a famous writer, and she totally fooled me. Half hour later, it's like,
I mean,
you know, it's me, and you know we're hanging out, and you don't recognize my voice. I'm like, oh, man, that's just mean.
But, yeah. Yeah, but, you know, it's also – like the people who love you the most are the ones that can punk you the best, I feel, you know?
Oh, yeah, yeah. My favorite thing she said before we went to the reading, she goes, if I hear one fucking thing about cockroaches and revolutionaries, we're leaving right away. 2 minutes into the reading, somebody mentioned the word revolutionaries. They go, we're getting tacos now. I'm like, I guess we're leaving. I'm glad we didn't pay for this one.
Yeah, man. Oh. Yeah. I mean, you know, Rafa, that's the other thing too, brother. There's too many people in LA, man, that, you know, they think by posting something on Facebook that they're revolutionaries, man. And I don't see them. I don't see them in the community. I don't see them at the community centers. I don't see them at the libraries, like tutoring kids. I don't see them anywhere outside of social media and their self-importance. You know what I mean? And my thing is like, look, you want to be a revolutionary, man, come and start and work at the library. You know, volunteer over here.
Yep.
We got kids, you know what I mean, that can't, you know, that could really use help reading. We got, you know, things that need to get done. We have programs that we're trying to get off the ground. Like, don't post on Facebook and call yourself a revolutionary, and then I don't see you, you know what I mean, in the community ever. You know what I'm saying? Like, I don't go to readings because I have kids and I have a family and I got other shit to do. But, yo, I work squarely in the community, and you don't see me walking around, you know, calling myself a revolutionary, because I'm not. I'm a civil servant. I'm a librarian. I work for the city and I work for people. You know, that doesn't mean I can't be revolutionary. That just means that's not what I'm going to call myself, because it's kind of silly.
Well, no, the thing is,
you know, that's like
the funny thing is I never called myself a poet until somebody else started calling me a poet. I mean, I generally don't call myself a poet. I let other people call me that. And to me, that verifies that if someone else sees my writing as something they like and they're going to call me a poet, great, but I'm not going to walk around, you know, saying this is me, I'm a poet, bragging about it, because
sure. You
know, I don't even brag about the running.
Absolutely.
I go, everybody says
right.
I'm an elite runner. I go, I run, but I don't call myself that. I mean, I think calling yourself anything has a way of jinxing it, you know?
Without a doubt, man, without a doubt. I mean, it takes away a lot of the mystique and a lot of the mystery, and like, without a doubt, man. I share those opinions about, you know, what we call ourselves. I still don't know whether I'm just a writer, a poet, a student, a librarian, a dad. I really don't know. I think several hats, you know, that we wear. So, I mean, you know, as long as you're faithful to those hats and loyal, you know, to the things you call yourself,
yeah.
I think, you know.
I tell everybody one thing I don't want to ever do is lie in the poetry. And they go, what do you mean? I go, once you start making shit up in your poetry and becoming a liar when you write, then to me, that's the ultimate lie. You're not faithful to your own words. You're not faithful to who you are because you're lying in your work. You know, I hate that.
Yeah, yeah. Well, again, you know, it's like it's real easy to talk about the revolution in a poem, and it's real hard to go out every day into the community and like do the work that's required, right? But I don't think, you know, you can be one without the other. And, you know, if people want to, you know, flights of fancy, you know, it is literature, right? It is poetry. You know, we're talking about a venue for hyperbole, you know what I mean? A lot of times, right? So like, you know, if people want to make it a little bigger, that's fine. But there's a big difference, you know, between, you know, writing a poem and like, you know, teaching for 10 years in the inner city, right? Or whatever, you know, being a librarian in South Central, right? I think there's a huge difference, you know, and I don't need to point it out, but, you know, if we're talking about it, it's definitely something that I think about a lot. Like, I know who does work in the community, and I know who is just sitting there saying, you know, they're a revolutionary, you know, that takes no effort to say you're a revolutionary.
Yeah. There's a lot of poets that I don't get along with because, I just look at what they do. Sometimes what they do to me is vulgar in the way they go about poetry, and I stay away from them. I'm not going to mention any names, but they know who they are. But the thing is, just, you know, I to me, poetry, you either do it the right way or it's kind of pointless, you know. It's,
sure.
You know, why do something if
I
you're going to do
that.
It wrong? It's like if I'm going to run a marathon, I'm not going to cheat. You know, and then say I did 26.
Right.
You know,
right.
It's not true.
Without a doubt.
You're lying
What's
to
the point? Right. That's right. That's right. And then, like, what's the point of that, right? No, no, for sure. I mean, I agree with you, man. Like, for me, like, in terms of poetry, like, I'm always reading people like Nazim Hikmet, you know what I mean? Like, Roque Dalton, know, like you said, like, people who, like, live, like, what they write. It's not like they wrote it and it was different. No, like, you know, Nazim Hikmet spent years in jail, you know?
Yep.
Sorry.
Well, it's like you mentioned Roque Dalton. Me and Iris and Richard, we had a whole show talking about Roque Dalton. So I respect her because she knows the history. You know, she actually would want to talk about somebody that has something to do with history with her culture. Yeah, I'll respect the poet more than the poet who writes the greatest line but doesn't know shit, you know?
Without a doubt. Without a doubt, man. And it's a lot of that stuff is lived, too, you know? But she, Edie's... is in the community helping people, you know, as a healer, right?
Yeah. She kind of helped me out a little bit with my eviction problems. She steered me to right people, but somebody like that, you know, they're hard to find because a lot of people, I hate to say it, but a lot of people are selfish and they don't like giving things away. You know?
For sure, dude. For sure. Very good point. That's a very good point.
There always has to be a back end for people for some reason, you know, and to me it's silly, you know, you help people to help them. I've helped a lot of poets out, and I don't mention names and I don't talk about it, but I know who I've helped and I know who I've connected with the right people, you know.
Sure. Sure. Without a doubt, man. Without a doubt. I feel the same way. And I feel really lucky also to have met, you know, people that I met, like, you know, because of this, I was able to meet Mike Songson and, you know, was able to meet F. Douglas Brown and, you know, these are all like leaders in our poetry community. These are people who are like elders now at this point, you know?
Well, it's like, I remember when I first started learning a lot was in 94 when I met Sandy Taylor, who introduced me to Luis Rodriguez, Martinez Spada, and a whole bunch of other poets. And he introduced me to Al Young, you know, he pointed me in the right direction. And it's like, you got to always respect gifts like that. You know, when people like that in your life come into your life that are willing to give you something and not expect anything in return, then they just enjoy the joy of giving you shit, you know?
Yeah, man, that's very rare. That's very rare, you know what I mean? But you're right. When you find someone like that, you really got to kind of hold on because, you know, there are generous professors and there are generous teachers and there are generous friends, you know, and like, if you can always hold on to them, it's always best because, you know, they teach you how to be better in the world. And that's always a good thing. You know what I mean? To improve, you know, how you do stuff, you know, is always a good thing.
You always got to remember and, you know, be thankful that certain people have come into your life. I mean, you know, people like Michelle Saros, people like Luis Rodriguez, they're rare people that come into your life and they bring you something. And, you know, you've always got to respect what you've been given. You know, you can't forget that you've been given a gift by these friendships.
Without a doubt. Without a doubt, man. Without a doubt. That's a very good way. Especially, you know, like I met, you know, Luis back in 2001 or something, you know, because of Martin Espada. So, I always consider that a gift. He actually wrote the intro for Tlaquilix, and you know, I was really how can I say it? I felt very grateful, you know what I mean, that I was able to meet him and that he was able to help us out and write us such a strong, beautiful intro for our book, you know.
Yeah.
He's amazing, dude.
I'm grateful for everybody I've got to meet. I'm grateful that, you know, Pinsky took my calls when I was on my vacation. I was kind of amazed that he took the calls, you know. But,
yeah.
It's poets who don't hold your shit against you that I appreciate. You know, they don't hold your history against you.
No, man, no. I mean, that's useless, you know. We're all trying to outgrow our history, right? We're all trying to be better than we were yesterday, you know.
Thing is, you got to learn from yesterday.
For sure, man. For sure. Well, hey, speaking of learning, man, I'm so sorry, but I got to get on now. I got to get on this, on this meeting that I was voluntold to go to. Do you want me to call you back when I get off of work, or should we
call it a day? No, that'd be cool. I should have someone calling in right now. I should have my next guest on in a second, hopefully.
Yay. Thank you, Rafa. I'm sorry, bro. I'm so sorry.
Right.
But,
there
you know,
he is. And you know what? No. You know what? I always try to accommodate, and it always seems to work out. And thanks for being on the show.
For sure. Thank you, brother. Thank you
so
much.
Quickly,
do you have
anything coming? Oh, wait a minute. Do you have any readings coming up? Anything coming up in the near future before we go?
No, you know what? We're going to be at the Chuchas, I think August 12th. And then I think we're doing a thing in Pomona at Books y Café or Café y Libros or something. I don't know the exact dates, but look out for it, and we'll see you there. Thank you, Rafa.
All right. Thanks a lot.
All right, kid. Bye. Thank you.
All right. And now we have George Southgate. And how are you doing?
Great. Great day.
So you're 75 and you've done 503 marathons. I'm still trying to grasp at that. The number 500, you know, it's like, it's a big number. It's not like, it's not even like 100. You know, when someone tells you 100, I was kind of like, wow. But you used actually the number 500, so that kind of puts it above wow. It's kind of like, what the fuck?
I've done 105 in Georgia.
Wow.
That's 23 marathons in years.
When did you start running?
I started running when I was about 33, just about 32 or 33 years old. That's 42 years ago.
All right. When did you start doing quantity running? Because I don't think you ran, you know, a whole bunch of marathons like you do now when you started. I mean, when did you start? Go ahead.
I did three around 1980, and then in 1995, I did the Atlanta Marathon, which they had the Olympics in 96. So we ran a course at Thanksgiving that they used as a kind of get the kinks out for the Atlanta Marathon, the Olympic Marathon in 96. So we didn't finish in the stadium they were building that, but I did that one. Then since 2000, I've started doing a lot of runs, not more marathons.
How does your body take that? I mean, that's a lot of punishment on the body. And at 75, how do you recover?
Your body tells you what to do. After I had the heart attack, and I asked the heart doctor, the cardiologist, and he said, listen to your body, and it'll tell you what to do. So when you're running and you get tired, you do what you can do. So you have to walk some, push them under. Usually there's a six-hour cutoff, sometimes a seven-hour cutoff for a marathon crowd. And I run 5.5 hours for the normal marathon. So I'm able to do it, and you learn to listen to your body. If there's something's hurting, you have to allow for that. You do what you can. You can really do more than you think you can.
Well, yeah, I could tell that by talking to you. And you've done 47 states so far, right?
On the fourth time around, yes.
Wow. What happened to the other three? You didn't want to do them?
Well, I haven't got to them. Friday when I did Wyoming, that was state 47 on the fourth trip, so I've got Alaska scheduled in August, and then I've got to work out Washington State and Montana to finish for the fourth time.
Wow. Have you done any marathons, like, in other countries, or you just stick to the states?
I stick to the states. It's such a beautiful country. There's so many places to see and so many adventures to do, and you make a lot of friends with the 50 State Marathon Club as a nonprofit group, keeping track of people doing their states. And so when you go to marathons, you meet people. The marathon there, I probably knew 15 out of the 50 runners that were there from running in other places with them. And it becomes a family, and you enjoy time together and the time before and time afterwards, dinner and visiting. And you learn a lot about the country and about people and different places that you wouldn't necessarily have visited if it wasn't for going to do a marathon.
Yeah, that's I definitely noticed the community as I run more marathons and I do more running. I notice people are really supportive. When you're running, they're, you know, they'll actually talk to you sometimes when you're running if you're tired to keep you going.
Right.
Which I really appreciate, you know.
The marathoners, if you ask veteran marathoners who've done a bunch, their greatest joy is helping a first-time marathoner finish. The last, you know, when they get past mile 20, they start slowing down and have trouble, and you come alongside and encourage them and help them. And to help somebody finish is a great joy as much as finishing for yourself.
No, I agree with that. I remember the half marathon I just did. I lost both contacts, so towards the end, I was following this one guy, and it's like he started slowing down. I go, dude, I'm following you. He goes, what do you mean? I lost my contacts, and I'm following you, and if you're going to slow down, then who am I going to follow? He goes, oh, there's white lines on the floor. You haven't seen them? I go, no contacts.
Right.
But, you know, he helped me out by telling me, like, to look at the floor to see, look for the white, you know, the white arrows, so that helped out. But it was I noticed that the running community is very supportive of other runners. I mean, it's one of the most supportive communities I've been involved in.
It always is, yes. And if you stop in a hurting stop for some reason, the next runners will stop and ask you if you're okay, if you need help, or if there's anything wrong. They're not worried about their time. They're worried more about you. If you got an issue, they'll stay and be with you to kind of help you get through or to find some help or whatever you need.
Yep. No, I've noticed that. You know, I actually encourage people. Like this one kid keep breezing around me. And I go, dude, I if you keep stopping and then passing me by, you're going to give me a complex. He goes, what do you mean? Every time you take a break, I'm running along and you're not around, and you come by whizzing by. It's starting to get on my nerves.
Yeah.
He goes, he laughed it off. I go, dude, but it was kind of funny because, you know, I'm 56 and this is like this young kid. Just every time he takes a break, you know, he just come whizzing by me afterwards, like two or three times. I'm like, oh, man.
That's why in the marathons when they have relayers, they do five of them do the 5 miles and last them to 10K. So at mile 15, some guy goes flying by and you wonder, how's he doing so fast? Well, he's only run a mile. And by four, he's walking and you go by him. And that's not bad at 5 and 10, but at 15 and 20, it's harder to catch him. But they just starting out and they go whizzing by you like there's nothing wrong. You wonder what's going on.
Well, yeah, I've noticed that. But I don't know. I don't know. What do you get out of the run? Because I know it makes me feel good. I ran 10 today, and I don't think my day would be great without the 10, you know.
Right.
I need that run in the morning.
Right. If I go several days without running, sometimes my wife will mention, go out and run. You need to get in here feeling a little grumpy. But there are some days you can go out running 10 miles and it's easy. And other days you go out 3 miles, just seems like a lot of work. It depends on where your body is and what's going on in the condition.
Yep.
Things vary.
Yeah, no, today was easy. I mean, I try to hill run all the time because most of these runs, you don't know when there's going to be a hill. So I always try to stick a hill in the run just to keep the strength in the legs to be able to go up hills, because you can always tell when a runner hasn't run hills when they do a trail run and they're walking up the hills because they haven't trained themselves enough with the uphill.
Well, the other thing, us older folks learn that if you're going to walk some, you might as well walk the hills. You pick your spots.
Oh, yeah. Well, dude, 500 marathons, you can do whatever you want at this point. I mean, that number is still, like, reeling in my head, like, wow. I mean, it is a wow thing that you can actually say you've ran 500 marathons.
Yes. And if you look up the mega marathon list, it lists people with 300-plus marathons. So once you get to 300, you join the list. There's no awards or anything. It's just they update it twice a year, so you can see where you rank as far as North American marathons.
Wow, that's good to know.
The number one fella is about 2310. Jim Simpson is second at over 2100, and Henry Rudin from Wisconsin is about 1750, is number three for the nation, for North America.
Wow, those are big numbers. I mean, how do you manage to rack up that many numbers? I mean, that much mileage.
They're doing
a
100
lot.
Marathons a year. They do 103, 104 marathons a year.
See, I mean, the body's got, I know I recover a lot quicker than I used to. I mean, I can run a marathon and run 10 miles the next day and just keep training. how does the body recover from that much, you know, stress on the body?
Well, part of it is some of those fellows are walking and they're taking 8 hours to do the marathon. And so it's a little easier. But the other thing is I tell people, some people do one or two marathons a year. And I say, you start training and you build up to it. Once you get in condition, if you maintain the condition, if you run a marathon, say once a month, you don't have to do as much training in between. It's easier to maintain the level versus trying to start mm-hmm. over again and build back up. So like you said, once you run a marathon and you do some of that running, you're in condition, your body can handle it better than starting out and trying to build up and then trying to start out all over again. Because over a period of time, you lose the strength you've got.
Oh, yeah. No, I noticed some people tell me their headspace is trained for a marathon, but to me, I run 10 miles a day just because to me that feels good. People tell me that's a lot, but to me, that's my normal, you know?
Right.
That's what feels good. I mean, pushing to 15 or 20 probably won't feel as good and it'll become exhausting, but I know staying at 10 right now is good. So
to me, weekly mileage is more important than daily mileage. Because someday your schedule works or you don't have time to run, and sometimes it rains. Other days mm-hmm. you feel good and you can do a little more. And to me, the weekly mileage is more important. But if I do, like if on Saturday morning I do a 5K, I count that as 6 miles in my weekly mileage. Because running a race with a crowd, you run much harder than if you're just out training by yourself running 3 miles.
Oh, yeah. No, I agree. I tend to be more relaxed when I'm running by myself. And I'm not about a lot of runners that I know pace themselves trying to bring up their time. But the thing is, when you're at a race, it's a totally different headspace and your focus is different. You're just trying. I mean, I'm trying to keep the pace up to a certain level so I can get a decent time. But when I'm running just to run, I'm not worried about that.
Correct. And the other thing is you're with people. That's like in a marathon. You'll end up matching up once you get to mile two or three. You're running with people about your same speed. And you run with them and talk with them and visit. And if one person slows down, the other one will keep them going. So you say, well, I'd slow down. Well, no, I want to keep going to run with them. And then you help each other out, keep going. And same in a 5K, you don't want that person, that little old lady with a stroller passing you when you're running the 5K. Your ego says, I can't let them beat me, and I've got to go. And so you push it to catch somebody or push it to stay ahead of somebody. You're just out there enjoying the run.
Well, I think the most important thing, I mean, as a runner, is you have to enjoy running. I enjoy it. It's not don't want to do. I want to do it. You know, once it becomes a job, then it's not going to be enjoyable.
Correct. And the difference is there are racers and there are runners. Racers plan one or two runs a year to win. Runners go out because they enjoy running and they're not worried. If they don't win, they're okay. Racers sometimes will quit if they see they're not going to win. They'll quit partway through. Runners go out and enjoy the running. And the more they can do, the people they meet, the place they see are the enjoyment part of it. If you win, that's a bonus.
Well, I agree. I mean, I just want to run, and it's like I've actually come to start becoming picky about my marathons. I mean, there's marathons I like, and there's marathons I don't like. I don't like the LA Marathon, but I run it just because it's the LA Marathon. I don't like the course. I mean, have you ever had a course? I mean, are there any courses that you don't like, but you do because they just are?
Yeah, there's some that, I need one here. I've got the months where I can do one, and it fits in. And sometimes it's a state I need because it's the only one you can do in that state because of my work schedule. You have to work around it. But, for example, the Mississippi River Marathon in Greenville, Mississippi, they bus you around, and you run 13 miles. It's a kind of a big C. You run 13 miles in Arkansas, cross over the Mississippi River, and finish the 13 in Mississippi. But I like it because it's the most beautiful view you'll ever get of the Mississippi River. Because when you go across the mile-and-a-half bridge, you're running next to the rail. In a car, the railing blocks the view. When you're running and the railing is about waist high and you're out there for, 15 minutes, you can see the land below, because the bridge is much wider because of the delta. But you can see all the currents. Mm-hmm. You can see there's land down there, trails running around, some animals in there. When you go across the river, you see all the swirls. You see the barges and rivers. And it's just an amazing view of the Mississippi River when you're on a bridge running or walking across compared to driving across. You really get to see all that's there.
Well, that's kind of what I enjoyed about the San Francisco Marathon, because I got to run across the Golden Gate Bridge. And I got a better view of the city. Plus, I mean, I enjoyed, running the bridge.
Right. When you're driving, you don't see
as
much.
No, because you're just whizzing by. And that's the thing I actually love about running. I've learned more about my city from running, because I've actually run different parts that I've never ran before, because sometimes I get bored. So I'll take a different turn and I'll find different ways to run. And I found trail runs that I didn't know were there, because I've gone exploring, which I wouldn't have gone exploring in a car.
There you go. Right. I did the Redmond Forest Preserve run outside of Seattle, Washington. It's out the northeast side, and it's a beautiful up and down the hills. It was five mile loops, basically. And it was a nice wide trail, so you could pass people coming to you. You didn't have to worry about traffic. And it was up and down. The Forest Preserve was a beautiful forest out there in the northwest. It was a beautiful area to run. I've done it a couple of times. There are good people there. And like I say, you can run with people a while, you run by yourself some, but it's a nice trail run. Some trails are difficult. That one is wide enough path, and it's up and down gradual hills, so it's not a real difficult course.
What do you prefer? Do you prefer trails or the city runs?
Well, trails are fine, but at my age, you have to be a little more careful.
Oh, yeah.
So trails are a little more difficult. And, like I say, some trails are really tough to run, and they're real challenging. And then some of these overnight runs, it's just too dark to run on a trail. It's just have to be careful.
Are you telling me? I think Sunday when I lost both my contacts, I wanted to run home, but then I realized my eyes are so bad and the lights are so blurry that I'll end up getting hit by a car. So I didn't do a second run because it wasn't worth the risk.
I
need to see what's coming at me.
Talladega, it's a racetrack. You run around the track and out to the RV, and you come down through the tunnel and finish on the track. But that's a 2.5 mile racetrack. When you're on the backside, it's an amazing view of the stands and all that's going on. It's amazing. Daytona, you run around the track and over to the beach and then back to the track. And then the Charlotte half, you run around the track and out and down the drag strip and back, and then finish on the track. And there, the metal had a little car slid across back and forth the front, and it had the Christmas tree lights from the drag strip where the lights flashed and then flashed at the top when it hit to that. So those were interesting races to do with half marathons.
Wow. So what do you do for your nutrition to keep yourself able to run? I mean, how do you keep yourself, your body going? I mean, what do you eat? What do you do to take care of yourself?
Well, I usually have cereal, but I'm a peanut butter and jelly fan. I've eaten that all my life for lunch, so one meal I'll do that. And funny, the rest of it, I eat what's comfortable. The day before a marathon, I like to stop at Denny's or IHOP and eat pancakes. Most people have a pasta dinner. I like pancakes.
Wow.
And if you eat them at lunch, when you're traveling to go to the marathon, you can pick out like Golden Corral and eat all kinds of stuff. And then at night, just eat a nice meal to kind of top off the tank. It's hard to eat a lot the night before the marathon because you're starting to get excited and thinking about it, and you don't feel like eating as much.
That's funny because I reward myself after a marathon by eating like 20 pancakes.
There you go. The frosty,
I love pancakes.
Chocolate milkshake is good. Chocolate milk is great afterwards. The caffeine, it really replenishes you. And but like somebody said, we run like this so we can eat like that.
Yeah, no, I just ingested a large pizza before the show because I needed to not be hungry when I do the show.
Right. I tell people, if you don't put gas in the tank, the car don't go.
The biggest mistake I did was taking the diuretic pills to lose weight. And those things just, they wear you out. They don't help you. They don't do anything. When you can lose the weight on your own, you don't need those pills that they sell.
Right, right.
Those things were always a mistake, and I didn't realize it till, you know, a couple months back when I realized it was, you know, affecting my strength and my running.
Correct.
Definitely. No.
Your body usually tells you what, just like a little kid, if you watch the little kid, they'll eat. Sometimes there's certain things they don't like, but their body will make them eat certain things. And you do the same thing as a runner. Certain times things just appeal to you and you can eat it. But as long as you're running regularly, you keep your system
yep.
working better, you feel better, you can eat a lot of different things, and you can eat more because you're running and exercising. It's not going to build up and cost you.
Well, yeah, no, it's funny because I tell people 10 miles is easy, and he goes, "You're bragging." I go, "No, I earned this." He goes, "What do you mean? I've been doing this straight for 4 years, so I earned to be able to do 10 miles a day. I didn't just suddenly come to me, I do 10 miles a day. It wasn't easy at first. It's easy now."
Correct.
You know?
When you get your body in condition, your body understands and do what you can do. And if you miss a day, it's not going to cost you that bad. I did the other thing when I was building up my miles. If I did 15 on Monday, I would do 8 Tuesday morning and 8 Tuesday night and get in 2 runs. And sometimes it was easier to go out and run 5 miles in the morning and 5 in the evening with the schedule versus trying to run 10 miles at one time.
Yep, yep. I mean, I do 10 when I have time, but sometimes I end up doing 5 because I don't have the time plus my job. I can sometimes do a run or 3 hours and then take a nap later, but sometimes I don't like that. Sometimes I want to sleep all the way in, so then I get up later, then I got less time to run because I got to get ready for work.
Yeah. But see, you listen to your body, and that's what I was talking about. Your body tells you when it's enough and when it's too much, and you have to listen to that. Yeah. Sometimes people know it, but they don't listen.
That's the problem. It's the listening part. If you don't listen, you know, you can cause yourself all types of damage, you know.
Right.
I have given myself shin splints. I have, when lifting weights, I have lifted too heavy and messed up my biceps. I have done every wrong thing to learn from every wrong thing, not to do the wrong things anymore.
Call it experience. You've made mistakes along the way.
Yeah, I don't think any runner is going to know how to do it right away. I think getting a training coach is great, but I don't think I need one because I know how to listen to my body, you know, and
right.
I'm fine. But some people like someone, well, you know, to push them on.
Well, that's why I tell runners, when you get started, do some 5 and 10 Ks. You don't start out with a marathon. You do 5 and 10
yep.
Ks to learn
yep.
what you
yep.
can eat,
yep.
what you can't
yep.
eat,
yep.
what you
yep.
feel, what you don't feel, and build up to it. Then
yep.
if you do a half and then later on a marathon. But some people try to start with a marathon and they have no idea what they're doing or what their body can take or can't take.
You know, you have to listen to your body. And the thing, the eating is important. Sometimes I can't eat right, but I eat enough so my body won't be worn out by, because I don't eat when I wake up. I eat after I do my exercise, my lifting, and then my running. So I have to have enough put in the night before so I can wake up and do all this.
Correct. See, years ago when you did marathons, people had backpacks and all kind of stuff because, especially trail runs, there is nothing along the way. But the marathons now,
yep.
every 2 miles, there's an aid station. They got water and Gatorade
yep.
and then various
yep.
snacks for
yep.
you. So you don't have to carry the backpack and all the stuff that you did before. Some people still do,
oh, yeah.
But you can be a little more, you know, more dependent upon the races and knowing, of course, some of them, when you get there, they don't have anything, but you have to have something.
Most races now carry you have your choice of water or electrolyte drink now.
Right.
I tend to use electrolyte drink. I like electrolyte drinks better than the water sometimes. I'll do water, but I don't know. I mean, it might be me, but I don't really need water as much as somebody else does when I run, because I can do a full marathon without water. Though people say it's nuts, but I end up drinking like 7 bottles right off when I finish the marathon.
Right.
But
so it depends on the course and the temperature. If you
yep.
run an 80-degree temperature, it's different than if you run in 50-degree temperature. The water amount
yep.
makes a difference.
Yep. Yep.
Now,
yep.
the only days I've dehydrated is a couple of marathons where it's poured down raining and you don't drink enough, and it's amazing.
Yep.
You don't realize you're losing it. Even though it's raining, you're still losing moisture, and you need to hydrate.
Yep. Yep. No, I'm pretty sure, because I'm doing my first ultra, 31 miles on August 20th, so I'm pretty sure I'm going to have to hydrate and teach myself how to hydrate where I don't overdrink, you know, or you don't drink too much.
Because
I used to drink the electrolyte drink I used to take. I know I was gulping too much, and then to the point where I finished it, and then I didn't have anything left because I wasn't, you know, controlling it enough.
Right.
Yeah, 50K is a little more challenging, and you've got to realize at 26, you've still got 5 miles to go.
Yep.
So I've done a number of those, and that's always a challenge.
What's the most miles you've done? I mean, the most mileage in one race?
The 50K, well, actually, I've done a couple that are actually 33 or 34 miles, but I've done 16 50K, so enough of those. And again, now if you have a choice, you go to a marathon, now a half and a full and a 50K, I'm satisfied with the marathon. I've done enough.
I mean, right now,
for
me, it's more about just fulfilling something. I told my son I'd run 50 miles, like, in a couple of years just for him. So I'm just going to do it for him. I'm doing it more like, you know, this is your dad, showing, you know, his dad could do stuff. I still, you know, you still want to be Superman in your kid's eyes. So, you know, I want to do that. So every time I run, I wear a hat that says Max's Marathon Dad. You know, I always wear that hat for him.
Oh, okay.
You know, it's the little things that, you know, it's funny how the focus, when you focus on a marathon, it's the little things that help you out too sometimes, you know.
Right. And some of the marathons are unique now, do special things. I guess the best double I did was 2 years ago. I did the Hall of Fame Marathon in Cooperstown, New York for baseball on Saturday, and then drove up to Lake Placid and did the marathon there where the Miracle on Ice with USA beat Russia in the hockey game. And I thought,
wow,
that's a neat combination, the Hall of Fame one day and the hockey rink the special one the next day. It was kind of a fun double to do.
No, it sounds good. I mean, I'm definitely in, like, still in awe of, like, your 500 miles. I mean, that's still a big number to me. You know, it's still like, wow.
Right.
No, it's
I never expected or planned on doing that many. You do 200.
I don't think you plan on.
You're doing okay, and you just keep doing them, and
yeah,
they keep working out. So you do what you can.
Well, I'm into a lesser level. I didn't plan on running 10 miles every day, but it just got to the point where it's comfortable. You know,
right,
and your body says you can keep doing it, and you keep doing it. If your body tells you to stop, you're going to stop. But if your body says go, you just.
Well,
I did the Sand Hills
Marathon in Nebraska, and they give you a spur, a full-size spur afterwards. So I had to go back
wow.
the next year because I wanted a spare. I didn't want to just have – I wanted to have second spurs, so I had to go back to Nebraska to do that one again the next year.
Wow. Yeah, no, I there's certain marathons I want to do again. There's certain marathons that are off my list, and there's certain half marathons I'm going to keep. You know, the ones you enjoy, you keep doing. I think that's the way to work
right.
it.
And,
you know,
Mike,
I mean,
I've done the Snickers Marathon in Albany, Georgia, which is one of my favorites, 5 hours south of us. But I've done all 15 years, and so that's a streak. When you've got a group like that, you try to keep going to do all of them. I've done the Bowling Green, Kentucky Marathon. The expo and the dinner the night before is at the Corvette Museum, and they give you a ticket to
wow.
the Corvette Museum. You do the marathon the next day. Well, I've done all 10 of those, so there's only two of us that have done all 10 of them, so they give you a little extra swag. You know, at like last year when we did the 10th one, they gave us a little extra swag for being the two that have done all of them. So that's the kind of one you want
yeah.
to keep going. And you know the director and you know the course and the people, and it's enjoyable to go back and kind of a challenge to keep the streak going.
I know. I mean, it's – yeah, you know, they did something to a lesser extent with the L.A. Marathon. If you ran it in – November, if you say had to push it because of COVID, and then you run it in March to put your name on the back of a shirt, it's something, you know. It's a little bit of appreciation, and I appreciate that because, you know.
I did the Hatfield McCoy, and that's where I had the heart attack. But when you do go back the next year, they have signs along the way. They're about 1 foot by 2 foot, and it's got "Welcome back, George Southgate," and they're welcome back, you know. So if you've done it the year before, say 100 people, you'll have 100 signs out along the course at random places welcoming you back. And that's kind of a neat when you get done to grab your sign to take it home. And I've got one here in the house where it says, you know, welcome back because, you know, from Georgia, you've done the marathon. So that's kind of a neat thing. It was kind of encouraging that they put the signs out to welcome you there.
No, that's
doing it again.
No, I mean, I definitely appreciate that. But you mentioned the heart attack because I still find it amazing that you didn't know you had a heart attack when you were running the marathon.
Right. Well, it was, I was a half mile to go when we come out to the main road, and the marathon was finished with a half mile to the right. It was right at the motel. They had an aid station. I just got a little lightheaded, so I laid down to kind of get stable and got up a little bit longer, and then I kind of go a little bit and stop and still finished in a decent time. I got third in my age group, and I got done. They said, your blood pressure, so it'll give you an IV. I said, that's fine. So we rested a while and drove 6 hours home, but there was never any pain. I was just lightheaded and didn't know, you know, anything was wrong. We'd done it. There was mile 23 is a major hill, and so finishing, it was fine. And so I didn't know till a week and a half later that I went to the doctor. They did an EKG and found out I'd had a heart attack. I'd had 70, 80, and 100% blockage, so I had triple bypass.
Wow.
And they wouldn't let me run for 5 weeks, and then it was 4 months from the time of the heart attack. In fact, the heart attack was June 10th, 5 years ago today, last week. So after 4 months, I was back doing marathons. So, but there was no damage to the heart, and that was the main thing. It was, you know, it was an issue with some blockage, and once they cleared that, everything was fine.
Well, you know, I'm definitely want to try to, you know, do at least half the runs that you've done. You know, to at least get myself up to 150, which would be nice. I'm still on number 8. I mean, actually, I'm on number 9. I mean, I'm going to hit 10 probably in July. But
once
yeah,
you've done
I
10
mean,
states.
Hmm? You said once you've done 10 states.
States club, you can join the 50 state club. And it's only like $10 a year, and a lot of the marathons will give you a discount for being a member. But within the 50 State Club, you meet people and you get to know them, and they pick a reunion all the different places around the country where the night before they have a meeting and introduce everybody, and they present the awards as they finish their trip around the ones or some of the 100 or 200th marathon, that sort of thing. But the 50 State is really a family. It's a nonprofit group, and it's meant to everybody to have a good time and get to know people and enjoy more than just doing a marathon. It's a great group to be a part of.
Yeah, it sounds it. Well, I hate to do this, but I have to end the show. But you know what? I want you to come back when you hit your 50th state.
Okay, on the
4th. I definitely want to have you on the show. You know, when you hit, yeah, when you hit the, but you're on 47 now. You still got 3 states to go, right?
On the 4th trip. I finished the state 3 times. This is the 4th.
Oh, you have? Wow. So, yeah, no, get back to me when you finished all the states in the 4th time. I'd really love to talk to you about that because, you know, and plus I'm pretty sure you're inspiring to, you know, any young runner right now because you're 75 and you're still doing it. You know, because a lot of people don't keep up. They eventually, you know, stop doing it and, you know, they just let it pass. But I appreciate that you're still going. You know, you're still doing it. I really do.
Well, another word of encouragement. In school, I was always the littlest kid. I was always the slowest. I was the last one picked on a team. I don't really consider myself an athlete. My son and daughter are good athletes. But I'm a plotter, but I can stay with it. And you don't have to be fast to do a marathon. You can get out there and do it.
Nope.
And my goal at this point is not to be last and try to be, you know, I was the oldest in probably 15 marathons last year. The thing is, you can go out there and keep doing it, and it's not based on your time. It's based on, like you said, you feel good, you enjoy it, you meet people, you see places. And like I said, I was the last one picked in school when I was on teams. So it's not you don't have to be a great athlete that you can run marathons
nope.
and run and do a lot of them.
No, and that's a lot of encouragement to a lot of people who, you know, just are beginning. You know, some people are like still stuck at 3 miles and they're hating it. And it's like it'll pass. You'll get more mileage eventually, you know. It'll come. It's just a matter of doing it.
And even if you walk, even if you walk a lot, you feel better, your system works better, you just get along better by being out exercising. They said a lap at any pace still runs laps around the guy on the couch.
No, I mean, it's like today I wasn't going to run because I didn't get my contacts. I opened the door, my contacts are outside the door. I was on my way out, and I'm glad I walked out the door because I found my contacts and I could see again, and I did everything I needed to do today. I'm glad that
there
I didn't stop just because there's a little roadblock, you know, like a bicycle. But you keep going.
The Lord gives us, if we give the Lord a chance, he does great things for us. And like I say, we get out there and do and visit and just enjoy life. And because of the heart attack, because of the running, I was through the heart attack. I think if I hadn't been a runner, the heart attack would have finished things. And it was great to be able to do it and get through it and be able to go back out there.
Well, thanks a lot for being on the show. I really appreciate it. And look forward to it when you finish that fourth run around the States and talking to you again.
Great. I appreciate
it. Thanks a lot for being on the show.
Thank you for what you do, and I appreciate the chance to share. Hope to encourage some folks to run and get out and exercise.
I think you're the most encouraging person I've had on the show so far.
Appreciate that.
And now I'm going to promote some of the stuff I use when I run. I take Bolt from 6 a.m. run before I run. I drink it during the workout. It's been helping me, and I think it doesn't cause any bad effects, so it's a good thing to run. 6 a.m. does make some good products, and I also take CMA when I go to sleep to recover from everything, and I take Tribulus before I work out, and these are the things I'm taking. I take those two things from Insane Labs. These are the products I'm promoting today, and thank you for listening. Please come again. This has been Poet Runner. Thank you a lot.